pattern recognition. We'll have three lectures this week, and then we'll be done. We're going to do course evaluations in the lecture class, in class today, so I'll pass those out about 15 minutes to go, and so we'll take care of those. And it looks like we're pretty much on schedule. I think we should make it through all the lectures by the end of this week. So what I wanted to do today was to finish up our discussion of PAC bays and then to maybe do one or two slides on statistical significance, and then we'll wrap that lecture up on Wednesday. So in a nutshell, I'm kind of hesitant to ask this question, but I will anyway. In a nutshell, what's this PAC bay stuff all about? Let me bring up the slide on that. No, it's not probably, you think it's probabilistic. Probably approximately correct. Horrible name, I realize. It should be something like probabilistic something something, but no, that was Monte Carlo. So you build a machine, I give you some data, you build a machine, you get some performance. Now before you took this class, of course, you were ready, you would feel you were ready to graduate, so you'd approach your advisor and say, you see, I got a good error rate on your data, let me graduate. But unfortunately, now that you've taken this class, you realize graduate school is going to be much harder. Why? Why? So the question I asked at the beginning is, what is this PAC bays all about? And that's through, I think, the biggest set of blank stares I've had all semester. So we're making progress, I think. We're getting harder and harder subjects to deal with in this course. Okay, so you get your error rate, you get your data, you got your data. What's PAC bays all about? At a very high level. Right. Right? And, okay, and what does PAC bays try to do? What? Reduce the probability of the probability of error, right? We're essentially trying to, it's essentially a confidence measure. And that's why after this we'll talk a little bit about statistical significance. It's essentially an attempt to establish a bound on error such that you can be pretty sure that an error rate in this range is representative of all error rates you might get on that problem. And as we've talked about this semester, and hopefully as you do your research, you will now think about not running just one experiment to get probability of error, but taking your data and rearranging it to run multiple experiments and to look at the range of error rates that you're getting as a way of establishing the performance of your algorithm and whether your algorithm is better than the previous algorithm. So we, last time at the end of last class, we went through this PAC Bayes theorem, which is a little bit obscure, but it essentially tries to establish a bound on the probability of the divergence between your empirical distribution and your expected distribution in terms of the divergence between the posteriors and this fudge factor. So this is very similar in many ways to the bound we looked at with support vector machines. And today I'll try to bring those two topics closer together because one of the primary applications for the PAC bound measure has been what are called margin classifiers. And really what's happened, I would say, in the last 10 years is that we went from a specific instance of a margin classifier known as a support vector machine. That approach essentially was generalized and sort of created a field known as margin classifiers. And there are a lot of different ways now to build classifiers that look at the margin between the two classes and try to model that margin. And that's what we call a margin classifier. So applying the Pack Bayes bound requires some amount of specialization. Typically, we specialize to classifiers of the form where your decision function is going to be the sine of a weight vector, the dot product of a weight vector with your feature vector. So this is essentially what a support vector machine is, though we do this with respect to the support vectors. But classifiers of this form are one family of classifiers that have been for which this bound has been applied. So we also generally are interested in margin classifiers that use kernels, and not surprisingly, support vector machines are a major area of investigation, because with support vector machines you use both kernels and margins. Other specializations often include an assumption that the cumulative distribution is a Gaussian, and that the posterior distribution is Gaussian. And that's not surprising, since most of the specific results we've generated in this class relate to Gaussian distributions. And then also looking at a normalized margin, which is related to the dot product divided by the norms of the weight vector and the norms of the input vector. And there's also something known as a stochastic error rate, which we have a posterior, which is a function of a mean and a weight vector, and that's going to be the expectation of the a function of this margin. So to better understand this quantity, consider the case as mu approaches infinity. When the margin is negative, margin meaning, so when the margin is negative, we get an incorrect classification, and this function f bar will approach 1. When the margin is positive, this function will approach 0. So one of the reasons this kind of a restriction is placed is so that you can actually differentiate the machine and optimize the coefficients of the machine. So you need some kind of function that's amenable to differentiation. And that's often why they will sometimes produce a posterior, which is a function of this form. I don't want to dwell on that too much today. But under these kinds of assumptions, we can derive a corollary to the Pack-Bayes theorem, which describes the properties of a Pack-Bayes margin bound. So let's look at what that means. So for all distributions D and all delta on the range 0 to 1, we can write that the probability of the divergence between our estimate of the posterior and the true posterior is less than or equal to this expression, which has the mean squared over 2 plus the log of n plus 1 over delta divided by n, and that's greater than or equal to 1 minus delta. And then using this bound, we can also show a related bound, which is that the if we look at the true error bound and our estimated error bound, so this is a divergence between the estimated posterior and the true posterior, this can be shown to be less than this mu squared over 2 plus log of n plus 1 over delta divided by n. And the claim then is that this expression can actually be used to directly find, for example, the estimate of the mean and such. You can actually use this equation to derive the parameters of your learning machine. And since this bound involves this dot product, we can actually generalize this to a kernel-type dot product, which we talked about with support vector machines. And by doing that, then we can actually use this kind of a use this result and apply it to classifiers like support vector machines. So what's done then is to take the use a normalized margin. So the normalized margin is a ratio of the margin for a particular input vector x divided by that margin summed over all possible combinations of essentially. So this term on the bottom, you have n support vectors, and this is essentially the distances in the kernel space between all the different support vectors. So you sum those up, and that gives you essentially, you could say, a normalization constant, which then we can take the actual distance between a test vector and the support vectors and divide it by this and get a normalized margin. So this is sort of a modification to the way we look at margin classifiers, but using this kind of a margin allows us then to apply the some of the results that we got from this packed Bayes bound. We still have to find the mean, and that's typically done. You can do that numerically. So just sort of in a nutshell, what's being discussed here is that we have this concept of sort of a general packed Bayes bound. Then we specialized it to a particular type of margin classifier. And we made some assumptions about the shapes of the distributions and all these things. And under those assumptions, then you can actually you can use that bound to find a value of mu from your data that will satisfy the packed Bayes bound. And that mu will be different than the mu that you would get if you just took all the data and averaged it together, for example. So that's an example of how you can use the bound to derive a learning machine that's different, if you will, than what you would derive if you just looked at the data itself. You're trying to do some inference on the data based on notions of this packed Bayes bound. And so this is a very simplistic example. I haven't seen a lot of, at least in the areas I work in, I haven't seen a lot of applications of this to state-of-the-art systems, because most of the time I would think using the bound to find parameters of your models would be intractable. But the bound has been introduced on these simplistic problems, just to give you an idea of how it compares to things like maximum likelihood and Bayesian estimation. If you remember earlier in the semester, we looked at Bayesian estimation and ML estimation on simple problems like an unknown mean, and we derived some results. So they've shown sort of comparable results to those using the packed Bayes bound. So let me show you an example of that, just to give you an idea of what this looks like in practice. So here we have some data, and we don't need to really worry about the specifics of the data, but the yellow X's represent an actual error rate that you would get by taking a training set and get a test set, training on the training set, and then evaluating on the test set, and you get the performance shown by the yellow X's. And these vertical bars show then a similar error rate that you would get if you applied, for example, the Batticheria bound or any of the other bounds that we've previously talked about. And then these blue lines, dashed lines, show you the bound that you would get from using the PAC-Bayes approach. So what you see here is that the actual error rate on the data is lowest. And you could say, well, you would expect that to be low because that's a specific instance. But as we've talked about, if you take the classifier trained on that data and you now apply another data set, it might do worse. In fact, you would in general expect it to do worse. So we have a bound here based on trying to sort of extrapolate the actual performance for that particular test set. And then we have a bound here which shows you the performance you would expect on any data set. And naturally, this has to be looser because you want to be more confident. So what you have here is a situation where this classifier, you could say, would represent a classifier you have a great deal of confidence in, and therefore the performance is worse because it's a more conservative estimate. And at the other extreme, you have the yellow X's, which is perhaps the best classifier you could get on that data, but very specific to that data. And the difference between these two then becomes the difference between generalization and kind of specific specificity or specific performance. And this is another example where they have the same kind of comparison. So what we've essentially done here then is to just introduce you to a different way of thinking about the process of building a learning machine. And in this case, you're building the learning machine with a interest in creating a learning machine that's going to work well across a broad range of applications. So you can take the PAC-Bayes bound, and under some very specific assumptions, you can apply it and actually generate a learning machine that will give you performance close to the PAC-Bayes bound. Now, that performance will be worse than the performance you would get on a specific data set, but it should be a level of performance which is representative across if you drew lots of different data sets. So that's one example of the kinds of things that people do at the statistics end of the research in this field, is they worry about things like bounds and performance of classifiers and trying to relate those two. Now let's spend some time today. So at a high level, we can think about the PAC-Bayes bound as a confidence measure. So let's talk a little bit about confidence and about statistical significance. And hopefully by the end of this lecture, then we'll approach this problem from another direction, and you'll get a little bit more perspective on why we might be interested in something like a PAC-Bayes bound. So when we're dealing with experimental data, we're always worried about how representative the specific machine we got on a particular data set is, how representative that is of the whole problem space. And there's a couple variants of this that all kind of actually share some commonality in statistics. So the first question you want to ask is algorithm A better than algorithm B? Well, that means, is the probability of error that you got for algorithm A statistically significant? Is that difference between the probability of error for algorithm A and probability of error for algorithm B is that difference statistically significant? Now, there are very good ways to measure that, and that's something that you all should be concerned about when you're publishing papers. It wasn't that way about 10 or 15 years ago. People were doing a lot of publications where they were not looking at statistical significance. In my field, about 15, 20 years ago, we got very serious about this because we got tired of people saying, you know, my algorithm gets 99.1, your algorithm gets 99.0, therefore mine is better. And we now have some very well-accepted tests. In fact, the NIST, there's a link here to the NIST test that we use in our experiments to look at statistical significance. And if you don't publish that, those when you're, if you go up to a conference and you give a paper, someone's going to call you on that. So measuring statistical significance between two experimental data, experimental results is very important. Another application of this that you will deal with is when you're building an actual system and you get a result, you classify a pattern. Very often your customer is going to ask you, how sure are you of that answer? Okay, now the extreme example of this, one that I always like to talk about, is the person whose job it is to press the button that launches the United States nuclear weapons. This is a very big decision, right? Fortunately, no one's ever had to press that button. Why hasn't anyone ever had to press that button? Well, no decision has ever survived the, you know, 7 or 15 levels of verification that they use before that button is pushed. Now, what they actually do, however, is periodically they run a test. And sometimes the operators know this is a test, and sometimes the operators don't know this is a test. But they make sure that there are enough checks and balances so that the operator will never get to the point where they have to push the button. And I guess it's the president's in the loop on this, and you've all probably heard the stories of the president carrying around the little briefcase that has the codes and all this kind of stuff that he can verify. So this is a system that's designed essentially to never be used. There are so many, the hope is that we'll never have to resort to such a decision. So they put so many checks in that there has to be a 0% false alarm rate. All right, because a non-0% false alarm rate, it's kind of interesting. Even if you could say, well, you know, pushing the button, you lose either way, right? Because pushing the button is pretty much going to annihilate life as we know it on the Earth, I suppose, or something like that. But I guess, you know, if at least you get the satisfaction that you annihilated the enemy or something. I don't know. But anyway, if you think about this, you know, this is a decision where you have to have, this is probably the most extreme case of a decision where you have to have 0.0% false alarm rate. That's a requirement by the customer, and therefore you have to be very confident when you make a decision. So how do you build confidence in such a situation? They add a lot of checks and balances. So no single person is allowed to make this decision. Information has to come from multiple people at multiple levels in the decision-making process so that only, you know, there's no single person who can authorize that decision. A more benign example of that is a telephone transaction system. When you call these wonderful robotic operators now that seem to be on everybody's helplines on the telephone, and it gives you these five choices, and it asks you to pick a choice, you have a lot of leverage in how you can design that system. One approach would be to simply make a forced choice decision. Guess which of the five alternatives the person spoke, and route the person to that alternative. But the price you pay then is that some percentage of the customers are going to get routed to the wrong choice. And that perhaps will upset a customer. If you say, I want, operator, and it gives you customer service or something, you could get upset. So how do those kinds of systems deal with that? You've all used these systems, I presume. So when you call these helplines and you get a machine answer, you know, the first level usually is a machine trying to route you, and you speak one of the phrases that you're allowed to speak, Does the machine always route you to one of the N choices? N could be 5, N could be 3. Right, so one of the ways you try to, I try to defeat these systems is you don't say anything. Well, they've figured that out and they loop you back, which is really annoying. So then you don't say anything again and they loop you back. But sometimes when you do speak, it will say something like, I didn't quite understand what you said. Could you please repeat it? Now, what do you think has happened in that case? In that case, they've looked at the recognition score for one of the 5 choices and they said, well, the score is pretty low for all of those choices. So I don't have a great confidence that I'm going to make the right choice. So rather than upset the customer, let me try to get clarification from the customer. And then sometimes in the extreme, they will actually route you to an operator, a human operator, when they can't understand what you're saying. The recognition scores continue to be poor. So that's why when I usually want to defeat those kinds of systems, I usually just don't reply. And it'll time out after a while and send you to the human operator. But that's a system where you actually bias the recognition system. You will sit down with the customer and you will look at the debt curve, the trade-off between false alarms and substitution errors, and you'll mutually decide on a threshold which you're going to then either re-prompt people or you're going to route them to an operator versus route them to the choice that they spoke. Because you're trying to be as efficient as possible in routing people to one of the choices, but you don't want to upset people by making too many incorrect decisions. And then there's some systems where the cost of a false alarm or a substitution error is really low, so they'll just take action. They'll just do a forced choice action. Whatever they think the best choice was, they'll route you that way. And an example of that is like a Google search. Google, you get back all these things. It ranks them by score, but it tends not to tell you things like, well, I didn't, not your, sometimes it'll actually say we didn't find anything that matched your query. But most of the time, Google will report hits, no matter how bad they are. So that's a situation where they let you decide. They just kind of make the forced choices, give you the so many best hits, and let you sort through the data. They rarely say, well, you got a hit on that term, but we didn't think the score was good enough, so we're not going to tell you about that. So that's another application. And then the third kind of application where we use this type of thing is that as you're training your system on labeled data, you may observe that some of the data is producing really poor scores during training. Now, that's usually a red flag that one of two things can be true. One is that the data could be mislabeled. And therefore, one of the ways we often uncover mislabeled data is we run training and then you look at the data that's performing really poorly on the trained models. And very often that will tell you what your outliers are. Or that could be data that doesn't fit the model and really you really need to focus on that data. And sometimes that's the case. But when you're dealing with applications where you're doing essentially unsupervised training, you don't really know whether the data was correctly labeled because you don't have labels. So let's say you decide, well, I'm going to train models on all the audio data on YouTube. And I'm going to do unsupervised training. Well, some of the data is going to contain music and other things that just aren't going to perhaps match your voice application. How might you spot that data automatically? Well, one of the ways we spot that data is we actually use a confidence measure during training. And we only initially train update when we see data for which we have high confidence. This lets you go into really noisy environments like YouTube audio and mine it and find things which you can use to your advantage but ignore things which are probably so far away from what you're looking for that they're not useful to be trained on. So we also use confidence measures during training and often will throw out data below a certain confidence level. So there are a lot of different applications for these things and the general sort of topic that ties all these together are the notions of statistical significance and confidence. So a result is called statistically significant if it is unlikely to have occurred by chance. That's, I think, a great way to summarize a thesis or dissertation defense. As a reviewer, you sit there and you ask that question, you know, do I believe this person's results? What are the chances that these results are not correct? So a statistically significant difference means that there is statistical evidence that there is a difference. It does not mean the difference is necessarily large, important, or significant in the common meaning of the word. It simply means that there's a good chance that this result you're looking at was not the result of, did not occur by chance. Now, it's generally true that the larger the difference between two algorithms, the more likely the statistical significance is of that result. But statistical significance depends on the sample size and actually the distribution of the data as well. So you can't say from one experiment, these two algorithms, let's say, were different by 5%. On some other experiment, you have the experiment A, and you say, well, on experiment A, a difference of 5% is statistically significant. Now you try to take that over to some completely different experiment with completely different data, and you cannot simply say, well, 5% is going to be statistically significant on that other application, because the amount of the margin for statistical significance is going to be a function of the specific experiment. And of course, all this is going to be cast in terms of confidence. So that's another interesting thing about this. It's not a yes-no decision. It's going to be with 95% confidence, I believe that difference is statistically significant. And within your research communities, there will be some generally accepted levels of confidence. So the significance level of a test is traditionally based on the notion of hypothesis testing. In simple cases, it is defined as the probability of making a decision to reject the null hypothesis when the null hypothesis is actually true. These are decisions we refer to as type 1 errors, false positives, and type 2 errors, false negatives. The decision is often made using the p-value. The p-value is the probability of obtaining a value of the test statistic at least as extreme as the one that was actually observed. The p-value is essentially a confidence. If the p-value is less than the significance level, then the null hypothesis is rejected. The smaller the p-value, the more significant the result is said to be. The notion of statistical significance, the probability that an experimental result could not have been determined by chance, and confidence, how sure we are that this result did not occur, are intimately related. In other words, something's going to be significant with a certain amount of confidence. So the two are work together. So what we'll do next time is we will actually apply this to pattern recognition, and I'll show you some results and some ways this has been applied to actual pattern recognition systems. But if you haven't, since usually when people take this course they haven't been exposed to this formally, I thought it was good to spend a lecture on this general topic. So we'll talk next time about basic hypothesis testing scenarios, and we'll do that in terms of a coin toss example. Okay, so I'll leave the course evaluations to you guys, and we'll pick this up on Wednesday.